Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Carl Carlson once again join me at the table here.
Hi, Fred.
Hey, Carl. I'm looking forward to RAMS coming up in January. I just got my registration notice for that and booked the room. But that's the one time a year that you and I get to sit down and blame software engineers on all the failures that occur.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
That's right. Yeah, I'm trying to squeeze in a plug for their conference and the tutorial we're giving there, but also introduce software reliability, which to me, I'm a hardware guy. So I tend to understand just a little bit about software, and I've worked with teams that integrate software into products, and software is just about in everything nowadays. Even my coffee pot has code and firmware in it to run the timer and all that stuff.
Yeah, my mechanical engineering degree in the mid-60s in University of Michigan, the bachelor's degree, we barely knew what software was back then.
Oh, yeah. I agree. But I saw an article yesterday on LinkedIn that was basically saying, besides reading, writing, and arithmetic, you have to add coding. Kids these days need to understand code and be able to write code. And I agree. I think it's become an essential skill. And it's so integrated into products. Oftentimes when I start working with a company, I ask, well, where's your failures coming from? What are you getting back and what's your breakdown of where the failures are? And they talk nothing about, they only talk about the hardware failures. This power supply blew a seal, this one did that, all these mechanical things. And he says, well, what about the software related failures? Oh, those are just bugs. The software team fixes those and we ignore them. And then I said, well, let's break down how many times a customer calls and complains that their product has failed. What percentage of those are caused by your software team or by the software itself? And it could be the interface, it could be drivers, it could be firmware, it could be the various levels of software within a system. And it's often well over 50% of the failures occurring to the customers are software related.
And it's interesting, Fred, because sometimes it's not easy or even necessary to differentiate, is it a software problem or a hardware problem? Because sometimes it can be both. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. One of the earliest awarenesses that I had on this was when we were developing analog brake systems in the vehicle industry. The speed sensors would measure the speed of the axle. So you have the axle rotating, you figure out you have speed sensors. This is years ago. And over time, with axle wear, the speed sensor would basically go out of calibration.
Right.
And but we didn't realize that was happening. We didn't realize at first that the axles were wearing and that the speeds would go out of calibration. Then it would give erratic information back to the ABS controller, and it would not work. And so is that problem a mechanical problem, axle wear, or is that problem a software, a electrical problem with the speed sensor, or is that problem a software problem where it didn't understand what was going on and correct for it? And it could be any of those.
Well, you could blame the software guys first. Let them defend themselves.
Well, of course. And so it dawned on me then, and I've learned this lesson over and over throughout my life, which is it isn't as clear as it's one or the other, because oftentimes you can approach it multiple ways. You can improve the reliability of the axle in this case. You can improve the calibration of the sensor, and you can improve the software algorithm to detect and correct and make sure that it works regardless.
Right. And what I've seen in more than one circumstance is that you have that sequence of understanding what the problem is. And the easiest solution that you can implement this week versus redesigning the axle and new materials studies is to implement the software one to get you by. But now we've got millions, if not billions, of lines of code in a vehicle. And it's getting trickier and trickier to implement a software fix that doesn't break something else.
I'll give an RV example.
the famous maintenance beast that you have.
Yes, this is my RV is a fifth wheel. It's basically a trailer that it's a long trailer that is pulled by a truck, and there's a brake controller in the truck that sends the signal to the RV hydraulic brake system, and there's a brake actuator that reads the information from the brake controller.
Okay.
Now, I've had a problem that has occurred 6 times in the last 2 years where, for some unknown reason, the brakes in the RV go full on. So the trailer brakes go full on for a little under a second. Basically, mm-hmm. they jam on and then they go off. And the entire rig lurches. And it's a safety related problem.
Oh yeah,
I've had the vehicle checked top to bottom 4 times by the brake controllers and everything. They can't find a problem. I've had the trailer top to bottom. So there's an integration problem between the brake controller, and we've recently discovered what it was, and it has to do with a little signal in the trailer that was being misinterpreted by the brake controller.
Hmm.
It's basically a kind of a residual voltage, and we fix that and the problem goes away. But sometimes the software reliability problems can get very complex because you're integrated hardware, software, electrical together, and they can be complex.
I totally agree. It's we're just swimming in software code at multiple levels within a product. There's everything from the GUI interface down to the discrete logic circuits and drivers, which is all bits and pieces of that software realm. And I joke a lot about blaming the software guys, but anybody that sits in a darkened room for 8 hours a day is
yes.
staring at screens. But it's become an essential part of our products. And as reliability engineers, it's one that I've run into over and over again is that we need to integrate and work closely with the software teams and develop ways to estimate what's the goal for the reliability portion of your reliability block diagram, what include hardware, software, and human factors. And make sure you include all of those elements into setting goals and apportionment, but then measure it, track it in certain ways. You know, something I haven't heard in a number of years is that I heard frequently 20 years ago was, well, software doesn't wear out. Software doesn't have a reliability issue.
Mm.
So we just code and make it work. And then once it works, it'll always work. You know, as I'm rebooting my Windows PC.
Yes.
And that
should be thoroughly debunked. There is a subject of software reliability, and there are standards and procedures that can be used to improve software reliability. So those old memes that software is not that software reliability is an oxymoron, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should be debunked. In fact, do you know Anne-Marie Neufelter?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so she's I just saw the email where she's been leading that team that revised the IEEE 1633
mm-hmm.
recommended practices for software reliability. So that'll be a good show note reference for us because that she's basically pulled together a lot of the information that relates to software reliability. The other thing I was going to mention is one of the tools within software reliability is software FMEA. Mm-hmm. And that is a really useful tool. Sometimes on a system FMEA where you have software integration, which is very common, I'll include the software as functions in the system FMEA.
Right.
So you have different software functions. You may have a half a dozen or more software functions that can be right in the system FMEA. Other times, I'll recommend a separate software FMEA, which can be done at the high functional level, or you can do more at a logic level, or even down to the code level. But I rarely want to do software at the code level, only on the most critical areas, because there's so much code.
Right.
You could be involved in that for years.
That's right. And the same rules apply. It's focused on the most important pieces, and in this tops-down approach helps you to do that in many cases. So you can focus on the areas that will give you the most sense. Now, software design reviews and the iterative process of designing software lends itself to the software FMEA. Is adding that risk assessment piece to it helps focus those design reviews to not just focus on function, but what happens when it doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly right. Because the functions are important, of course, to identify, but understanding the failure modes, the way in which it doesn't accomplish the software function, and particularly important is understanding the effect, mm-hmm. which if it's a safety-related effect, then one of the most common tools is, well, actually two common tools, is fail-safe and fault tolerance.
Right.
And those in fault tolerance, you're basically, your strategy is to reduce the effect of failure to essentially a degradation of failure, not a complete loss of performance.
That's right.
In fail-safe, it says, if the failure occurs, let's make sure it occurs in a safe manner. And sometimes the software specifications include the safe operation. In other words, if something happens, it happens safely. Sometimes they do not.
Right.
And so it's important for the software reliability team or the software FMEA team to make sure that every potential failure fails in a safe manner. And so there's different strategies that can be used, but two of the common ones in software reliability and in software FMEA are fail-safe and fault tolerance. So I encourage people to become very conversant with those techniques.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does when we're building a system and evolving the software that's installed on the system, we often find software bugs. And the whole concept of FRACAS, the Failure Reporting and Corrective Action System, to me, it was always a software tool, and the hardware guys adopted it eventually in some programs I've been involved in. But just keeping track of all of the defects and bugs and anomalies and noticing those is a chore in and of itself, beyond the more rigorous design-related elements of fault tolerance and fail-safe and just does it function with enough robustness to handle itself.
Yeah, that's right. FRACAS is a great tool, and I agree with you. It can be used on software or hardware or both. And good software is important because you need to aggregate the different bins of failures or bugs. In other words, if they're similar, they go into one bin. If they're different, they go into separate bins so that you can use statistical analysis to find out how often a particular problem is occurring. But then you can also track resolutions and then hopefully feed that information back into the design process. A good FRACAS system ongoing becomes great input mm-hmm. to a software reliability program or a software FMEA, or really into the overall product development process, not just for software.
Yep, I agree. And it's one of the things that by not waving your hand saying, oh, that's a software problem, it's a known issue. That's my favorite. It's a known issue. Well, it just shut down your prototype. You know,
yeah.
You can't evaluate the 20-hour runtime test that you're doing because it keeps failing for a software bug. That's a problem, guys. But by simply keeping track of that, one of the old tools that's out there is just a reliability growth, is just track the number of failures you get over time and plot the cumulative number versus that time. And if I ran into this years ago, where we gather the data from their fracas system, we put it on a simple plot, and it was a nearly vertical line. Is every day they were finding 10 new problems, yeah. Right? For example. So this is just this steady vertical line going up across time, and greater than 45 degree angle. And they were going to launch in a month. And I said, well, you know, have you found and fixed all of the problems yet? And looking at that curve, they're like, we don't know. We don't think so.
And really, when you have that type of vertical or steep curve, it shows that you're not using good software reliability practices. Because ideally, as you introduce software and embedded software and software systems and integrated with hardware, you don't roll out an increasing failure rate type of scenario.
Right. That's right. It should be becoming harder and harder to find the next bug.
Yeah.
And once that curve rolls over, is what I would call it, it starts to flatten out. Now, theoretically, you get to a point where if you fix one bug, you introduce another one, and you get this diminishing return. I don't know. In practice, I've never seen that. But we go from 10 a day to 2 a day to 1 a week, and I'm like, all right, it's stable enough now that we're good to release. And what I've used it before on is that this one team had, I think, one test bed to run the compiled code overnight through a series of test suites, and they were finding issues with it. Lots of issues. And the problem was that some of the issues would shut down their system. And so they got limited actual runtime on this software and running all of these diagnostics. And so the solution was, well, let's add 10 more software test beds just so we get more time on running the system and find more bugs faster. And the program manager is, what? We don't want to find more things. Well, right. Yeah, you do. you want to find the ones that are important. There's somewhere in here, there might be a particular issue that's throwing off all of these errors. So if we can find a larger number of these things and do the analysis to figure out, well, what's the root of all these problems, you could solve 100 of them all at one shot by solving the right one. And that logic kind of struck with him, and he said, okay, let's. So they installed a bunch more test beds. We're finding 100 new bugs overnight. But it quickly illustrated that there were some commonality and some source issues in this one module of the software. Once that got analyzed and updated, we were down to one a week. It just eliminated all these symptoms that were manifesting in various places.
You know, a lot depends on the industry you're in. Some industries... Microsoft might be an example. The industries will, and not just Microsoft, but the basically software developed for computer uses, they might have a new version. And the question becomes, what level of reliability do you have to achieve before you launch?
That's right.
How much can you place on to the customer? Do you use betas and, you know, different versions in order to try to encapsulate the problems before they get to a much broader group? So there's different strategies in terms of rollout, but it depends on the industry. If you have a highly safety-dependent industry, aircraft, for example, then the software development and launch is more rigorous in terms of what you'll tolerate as a failure rate before launch than a
smartwatch, for example.
Smartwatch is a good example. Thank you.
Yeah. I agree. And that'll vary by industry and so on. One of the questions I got for you, Carl, you're talking about, well, how good is it, is how do you measure software reliability?
Well, first of all, you can start with prediction, and I know that's a controversial subject by itself, but there are software model prediction models mm-hmm. that are, some are code-based, some are time-based, lines of code, different ways you do it. And that's a whole subject in itself, and there are standards and papers written on software reliability prediction. Now, in terms of measurement, my personal view is it'd be a categorization similar to hardware. Mm-hmm. In other words, all you're doing is designating this as a software problem or a hardware problem, and you're aggregating and keeping track of it that way. So sometimes it has value to differentiate. Sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
It really doesn't matter.
You stay at the system level saying, hey, the yeah. braking function is not behaving. So
exactly. And whether we want to call that, going back to that ABS, whether we want to call that a hardware because of the axle, or whether we want to call that a software because of the code wasn't robust enough to determine it, mm-hmm. May not add a lot of value at the system level. In other cases, it does add value because you go back to the groups to fix, and you're basically keeping track of embedded software or something like that. So, but it's essentially, from a tracking standpoint, it's similar in approach to hardware.
Yeah, and it becomes more of a, same as with hardware, is this problem that a customer reports to us and we do some root cause analysis on it, is this going to affect every product, or is this unique to that particular unit or circumstance? With software, oftentimes the default is that it's going to affect every unit, so we fix it for every circumstance. But because it's so integrated with so much of our hardware and material systems, that the local temperature and use behavior may actually be a corner case that isn't as high a priority to fix as the hardware problem that affects every unit. And
right.
So I see a lot of parallels, a lot of similarity. The one huge advantage for most software is that there's the .1 release that fixes a bunch of stuff a couple weeks after the initial release. Hardware is hard to do that. It's Samsung Galaxy 7, I think, if I remember the model number. You can't just use a wireless upgrade to fix the battery packs.
Yeah. Well, and one of the early things I learned, and I had tip to Dev Rahija on that because he taught me this personally, is where possible, it's important to and useful to look at the integration of software and hardware and to design the best system you can from a hardware-software integration. Mm-hmm. Then, yes, you can do software updates and stuff like that, but that hardware's got to be as robust as possible because you don't have that opportunity, like you point out, to change the battery pack.
Yeah, it's coming, though. We're going to get 3D printers in every iPhone, and then it'll print the new components, and you don't have to change the case ever again. That's coming. That's my prediction for the year 3000.
For the year 3000? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, going out on a limb there.
Yeah, very good.
Well, I mean, there's so much more to software reliability. And big pieces of that. So we'll have to add a link to that IEEE standard and some other references as we find them. But it's something that, as even us hardware-centric folks, at least that I am, and I know you are, Carl, is that we need to acknowledge and learn the software side of the equation, because it's so important.
We really do. To me, when we talk about reliability planning, which is one of the themes of our speaking of reliability, it's important to scope out not just the hardware design, also software, also maintenance, in other words, all the different aspects of reliability. And that's why you and I, Fred, are trying to teach and to explore the different aspects of reliability planning. It's not just the hardware design.
That reminds me, we should probably add a software piece to our tutorial coming up at RAMS. I don't think we don't really talk about it all that much.
Well, let's bring it up as we talk to the slides.
Yeah, yeah. Later when we do go through our practice and get mm-hmm. that ready to go. All right.
That
well, another subtle plug for our tutorial at RAMS.
Shameless.
It's the last week in January, and I believe the registration is open, and hotel rooms are at a discount rate at this point. So it's time to plan to go there. And if you'd like to sit down with us, we'd love to meet you. Our fan base is growing, and we'd like to put some faces to names. Last year at RAMS, we ran into a handful of people that said, hey, I love your podcast. We listen all the time. And one, we appreciate hearing that. Two is it gives us a chance to ask you, what do you like and don't like, and what would you like to hear about? So if you're going to meet us at RAMS, let us know. We'd love to sit down with you. If not, if that's not in your plans, feel free to go to reliability.fm, which is our podcast network. You can find the shows that are there and find comment fields and ways to get in touch with us. And let us know what you think, what's working, what's not working, what topics would you like to have us talk about. So please join the conversation, grab your cup of coffee, and let us know what's on your mind and what questions you have. Not only Carl and I, but the rest of the team would love to hear from you and focus the show on things that you're interested in. So with that, Carl, I think we'll wrap it up for today.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.